22-3099, Colt Energy v. Southern Star Central Gas Pipeline. Would counsel for appellant make the appearance and then proceed, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Lee Thompson, Wichita, appearing on behalf of Colt Energy and other interest owners in two oil leases in Kansas. We have appealed only from one facet of the order on summary judgment, and that was the claim for damages due to an intentional continuing nuisance due to migration of high pressure storage gas in close leases. The response to the summary judgment made clear that we were seeking a claim for damages which accrued as a result of a temporary nuisance within the 2 years prior to filing the lawsuit. And so that was a position stated clearly, I think, in the response as it relates to damages. And the damage issue is probably the most significant, and so I will address that first. When the court held that there was no evidence of temporary damages, I think that ruling had three components. One was whether there's evidence of damage sufficient to make a case for a claim of temporary nuisance. Second, whether there's a measure of temporary damages, and whether it's available. The basic law is that a claim for temporary nuisance is premised upon an unreasonable interference with the use and enjoyment of property. And our case and our response in summary judgment, I think, made clear that we were seeking damages for lost production of oil because the ability to produce oil was diminished, if not eliminated, due to migration of storage gas. We listed a number of additional facts which decided that impact of the migration of storage gas, and that, among others, is that there was actual production before we acquired the lease. There was a substantial amount of oil to be recovered, and ultimately there was a blowout due to high pressure storage gas in November of 2017, and that then led to the question of how Colt could continue to produce.
So let me ask you a couple of questions. One is as to the two leases at issue in this case, was there production, were the wells on these two leases producing at the time your client acquired them?
There was production in the years preceding when the wells were operated by the predecessor MAE.
Okay, the wells were not producing when your client bought them, right?
I think that's correct, and my client had experience in the field, whereas here there were older managers and inefficient management. They were able to increase and restore production, and that was a valid reason for acquiring leases.
Okay, fair enough. But also, as far as that goes, your client allocated zero value to these leases when they purchased them, as part of a package, right?
The client valued the entire package and based that upon prior current production. Since there was no current production, that is correct. They assigned zero value.
Okay.
But they invested considerable money and time to rework the wells, which was the original intent.
Okay.
However, the problem came due to the physical impediments to producing.
Right.
Fluid with high gas and safety.
Let me ask you about that. So what is the evidence in the record before us, in the summary judgment record before the district court, that there was high pressure gas in these specific leases? And I'm not asking about offsetting leases or leases in the area, but with respect to these leases, because I think you would agree to me that there could be high pressure gas you know, 1,000 feet away from one of your well bores, and it wouldn't necessarily result in high pressure gas at your well bore.
Well, the district court found that there was, in fact, high pressure gas in the roof lease based upon measurements of very high pressure taken throughout the lease, and secondly, based upon the eruption of high pressure gas, which occurred in 2017, and subsequently another eruption of high pressure gas and later in 2018.
Right, but I guess my question is were those, was that evidence of high pressure gas with other than the district court's finding that there was high pressure gas in the Rook lease, were the two blowouts on these leases, or the instances of high pressure gas on these specific leases?
Plus the measurements of high pressure gas taken on multiple wells throughout the Rook lease.
Okay. Could I ask a question? One of the problems the district court has was the failure to provide sufficient evidence that the nuisance could eventually be abated and that production could resume, and lack of evidence that established that would support that allegation for temporary damages. And then the damages calculation itself, as I read the expert report, the $7 million was the complete loss of use of the two leases. So, in effect, as I read the district court order, there was not a calculation of damages related to a temporary nuisance that could be abated. Could you address that, please?
First, as to a calculation of damages, the Butner expert report is a decline curve, which is a very common method of assessing the value of lost production, and it's based upon a yearly computation of the potential production that could occur. And indeed, the potential production was set out in various categories on a yearly basis, and that was evidence before the district court. As to whether or not it was available, I think it's important to note that the issue is not whether it was currently being abated, but whether it was capable of being abated, which of course is the critical factor in ascertaining the difference between temporary and permanent damages. On this fact, the district court looked at a citation that there had been a recycling of boosters and lateral equipment at the time that Southern Star expanded the field, including the swirl formation. And they said, well, that's no proof that it was being abated in the time of this case. But I think, A, it's a proof that it is available. And that was submitted to the Federal Energy Reserve Commission.
Why is that proof that it was abatable? That wasn't that 2008 that information was submitted? And why does that provide any sort of genuine inference, a genuine dispute of fact as it relates to the time of this dispute that it would be abatable, even if it would have shown that it was abatable in 2008?
Because the process by which it is accomplished is simply installation of compressors to withdraw the inserted storage gas, and there's nothing uniquely temporal about that fact. It's abatable and remediable, and that is available to Southern Star. In fact, that was the very basis that Southern Star sided with the FERC when they sought to expand the field very late in 2008, because it would enable them to recycle the gas from Squirrel Formation into the Colony Formation.
Well, that may be self-evident, but was there anything in the record that would have made the connection between the 2008 evidence and the time of this dispute as it relates to the question of whether it was abatable or not?
I think the record is limited to proof of what is the physical reality of the process, and that that was available and represented by Southern Star as being available in 2008, and there's no reason why that physical property and process was not available later. In fact, in a deposition testimony, that I asked their manager of storage operations whether or not they were using the recycling facilities they had. They said, no, they weren't. They had some problems with them, and that generally the booster compression worked, except when there were mechanical problems and it was down. Southern Star had controlled the Anstruther booster station and could have done that.
Well, let's talk about temporary damages again. And on the question of temporary damages, how do you square, the district court found the Butner report really actually showed permanent damages. And how do you square that with the Kansas Supreme Court's case in Short versus Wise in terms of how it determines that you evaluate this kind of damage and whether it is in fact, how you would, what would be the measure of damages in this situation?
I think the measure of damages is the value of lost production. As I understand the basic law in Kansas, it's either a reduction in long-term value or current usable value. And in this case, it's usable value, and that is set out in terms of production. We can't produce, and we have to set out in terms of production.
And why is the district court's determination that but the Butner report specifically it says is quote not an assessment of temporary damages? Why is that wrong?
I don't recall that it says that. That it's court.
Page 101, volume 5 of the appendix. Butner talking about the Butner report. It says. Quote, this is not an assessment of temporary damages. It is an assessment of the total and permanent value of the untapped oil reserves on the Rook and Coke leases, period.
Yes, I agree with that, of course. I think the fact is that the evidence in this report and conflating kind of the measure with the amount and the amount of damages that we saw after the amendment to the complaint. And the pretrial order was limited to the 2 years, and there are specific numbers and loss of damages attributable to those 2 years in the report. And that can be given a time trial. It can be amended without any prejudice whatsoever. The underlying assumptions, its values, its discount rate were all accepted by the other side. And so those 2 years preceding this were specified in his report. His opinion ultimately went, as Your Honor said, to the total value. There is evidence, and that's the key of summary judgment, that we could present to the jury a fact issue of what the actual damages were in those 2 years.
And what, and I, you may have said it and I didn't hear you, but what is your response to how does your with the Butner report and your corresponding argument associated with that square with the Kansas Supreme Court's decision in Short versus Wise?
I don't believe that case. I have to be totally honest.
All right.
Counsel, let me jump in here for just a minute and ask you a question about damages. Just to, so I, where the panel's clear on what your position is it your position that I mean, you don't disagree that your expert report and calculations were for a permanent loss of the resource, right? Not a temporary loss.
There were calculations of loss over a period of time.
Well, it was assuming, let me stop you because we're running out of time, but the calculations were assuming that you were never going to produce the oil, correct?
Under the current situation, yes.
Okay. And so, but your position is that it was appropriate for you to create an issue of fact to pluck out 2 years from that report, to show that there were damages and that would create a genuine issue of material fact.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
That is the claim we made for those 2 years. I don't think I have any time left, so I appreciate the court letting us appear in this fashion today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, and Samantha Woods appearing in Wichita, Kansas, on behalf of the Appalachian Southern Star Central Gas Pipeline. There are three remaining matters in this appeal that I intend to focus my time on: the issue of the temporary damages, because that issue, unlike the other two issues, is fully dispositive of this matter. I don't think we need to get any farther if I have time to do so, though I will address the other two issues.
Isn't the question of abatement itself, abatement or not, dispositive of this matter?
Yes, Your Honor. The issue of abatement is dispositive of this issue. Tied into the question of abatement is the question of whether it can be done feasibly, whether it can be done at a reasonable cost. And then the sort of third prong of the temporary damages question is whether or not the plaintiffs have any evidence at all of a temporary damage relative to the Butner report.
Okay, and I'm just trying to understand analytically. I viewed, and this is where I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, I viewed that analytically, the question of whether you can prove a temporary nuisance, in other words, whether they can prove that this is an abatable nuisance, in itself stands apart from the question of whether they can prove damages of a temporary nuisance. In other words, either ground is dispositive, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor. Either is dispositive. If plaintiffs are not able to offer evidence that the nuisance is abatable, and again, tied into that being as feasibly abatable, nor evidence, and separately, of severe temporary damages, then yes, those issues are dispositive on any one of those what I'll call prongs. On the issue of the gas abatement question, what has really happened here is that plaintiffs have offered evidence, and offered only evidence to the district court, that conflates the idea of gas recovery with the idea of gas abatement. Those two are not the same question. There is evidence that, number one, is old. The evidence offered by plaintiffs, the only evidence offered, was of related to a 2008 FERC filing. That 2008 FERC filing was not arriving at the same question that is present before the plaintiffs as they are needing to prove abatement. So while the plaintiffs may have evidence from around 2008, depends on which filing you look at, but generally in that time frame, that there is an ability to recover some gas. That is a different question entirely from whether or not particular gas located on the Rook lease or the Cove lease can be abated now in order to remove enough alleged gas to allow plaintiffs to then produce oil, and whether or not that can be done feasibly within a reasonable cost.
Let me interrupt you for just a minute. And maybe you can answer this question. Is there, even if we accept the FERC application as being probative of something, is there evidence in the FERC application that high pressure gas on these specific leases could be remediated in a feasible manner?
No. There is not.
Okay, was the FERC filing a broader type of position by the appellee?
Yes, it was. The FERC filing dealt with permission by Southern Star to obtain further rights, both laterally and vertically. That there were discussions relative to the recovery system that was a part of that filing. But I would point, Your Honor, yes, the answer is that that's not there, but even what is what is there, what things can point to is not enough. So the actual citation that they pull out of that FERC filing to get to the question of abatement says that continued oil production can be a viable operation under recycling conditions. Here, you're talking about, number one, continued oil production. The road lease and the coal lease were not producing at the time that plaintiffs purchased the lease. They were not producing at the time that this lawsuit was filed. The road stopped producing in 2016. The coal did not produce since 2017. That is not continued operation, number one. Number two, we've already discussed the temporal issue, whether or not the situation of the gas and whether it can be recovered at this time now, given 12 or more years of oil, continued oil production out of these formations, there are a host of questions that are absolutely unanswered by any of the evidence and certainly unanswered by this FERC filing. The third piece of that is even this language says, can be a viable operation. This certainly doesn't raise to a level of the plaintiffs having anything to tell the jury, even if the FERC filing is what they have, that says it is a viable operation. It more likely than not could be a viable operation for the plaintiffs to come in and produce oil on these leases. Finally, that FERC filing is a more general statement, as Your Honor indicates. This, we are talking about a different segment of land. While the road lease is on the certificated boundary, the road lease is not. So whether or not those specific statements were being made relative to the road and the road lease, I think is very unlikely. But in all honesty, I don't think that anyone knows, because that wasn't the question that was in front of them as they were making those statements. So we get to, this is all that there was for the district court to say, I don't have the evidence of abatement here, and there just isn't the evidence of abatement. If this is all there is, this is not good enough, which is essentially where the district court ended up. On the issue of feasibility, which I have called a separate prompt, but it really goes to the same issue, there is absolutely no evidence that Southern Star can do what plaintiffs are saying to abate any gas feasibly. There is no expert in the case on the plaintiff's side that indicates, on anyone's side, that indicates whether or not this recovery system, even assuming that it could abate any gas that would there that's preventing oil production, could be done feasibly. No person has given any evidence on that at all, and I think that, again, completely leaves the plaintiffs no evidence on abatement that can go forward to the jury. Finally, I'll move on this particular issue, at least how I've conceptualized it, to the question of plaintiff's evidence on temporary damages. And this has been a bit of a circle to figure out exactly what damages plaintiffs were claiming. We did get a lot of it worked out in the summary judgment briefing. The case that we sort of went into at the filing of summary judgment and came out with after the briefing was finished, at the very least provided a significant amount of clarity as to what it is that plaintiffs were seeking. Procedurally, I would point out this was an integral part of our summary judgment briefing, and the plaintiffs did not respond to the issue of whether or not they had sufficient evidence of temporary damages. In the briefing, there was a reference that they were going to address it in a separate Daubert briefing. That briefing, which is part of the record on appeal, also did not address this issue. I think that the issue of whether or not plaintiffs have temporary damages has now been waived, such that Your Honor should not consider it. But even on the merits, even getting to the merits of the question of whether or not plaintiffs have competent evidence of temporary damages. What they have is a report issued by their expert, Mr. Butner, in which he indicates that essentially this is the universe of oil that exists that could be produced on the road lease and the coal lease, but for, and he assumes this, of gas on both leases. That, as we look at it in a temporary damages perspective, is not, because who would need to be available, is not an answer to a correct question. That is an answer to a permanent damages question. In fact, as it was presented in the pretrial order, the $7.7 million damage claim was presented as past, present, and future damages. That aligns perfectly with what the case law would call permanent damages. Plaintiffs have now attempted to take what they have in Mr. Butler's report and turn it into a temporary damages, or at least come up with enough to make an argument to get to a jury. Problem is, number one, it wasn't disclosed that way, but really at the heart of it is that that's not what the opinion is. That's not what Mr. Butler did. I wish I could come up with a better analogy. This is the one in the briefs and I thought about it, but I cannot. The question here is, on a temporary damages question, on a nuisance claim such as here, what are the damages for the inability of the plaintiffs to produce oil in the 2-year time frame? Not how much oil could have been produced, but what is the value of the damages for the delay in production? Because if, as they claim, it is available, they will eventually get to produce all of this oil. And a damage calculation that rises and falls on the amount of oil available to produce will necessarily lead to a double damage result. They do not have an expert that opines about the delay of damages. And again, the best analogy I can come to is this is not a crop case. This is not a case where there's a flood, so we've got 2 seasons of a wheat field that cannot produce wheat. Of course, you can go back once the flooding is abated. We can decide, we can determine what the value of the use of that land over 2 years was. This is not that at all. This is, after the gas is abated under Plaintiff's theory, Plaintiffs can then go ahead and produce all of that oil. That is what Mr. Butner's report says. So as we look at what is in the record, there is no way, whether you slice it, dice it, how you add it or subtract it, or there's any evidence that goes to a jury on the actual temporary damage question.
Let me just see if I can nail this down for in my own mind. The Butner report is saying X amount of oil is going to be lost and never be able to be produced, which would be a permanent damages type of argument. And your position is that in a temporary damages setting, the calculation is the difference in cash flows if you could have started producing it 2 years ago, as opposed to if you can start producing it now.
Yes, Ron, that is essentially it. It requires more, I think, an economic opinion than anything else. I think Your Honor can take judicial notice of the fact that the price of oil moves around, and that's certainly been so in the last 4 or 5 years. So I think not only is there no evidence of damage related to the delay, we don't have an expert that tells us one way or the other, but I think it's perfectly possible that plaintiffs producing oil now or producing oil in 2 years have a benefit of not producing it in a certain time frame. I mean, it could go either direction. But yes, Connor, that is essentially how that would all come together. I will raise the other two issues. These are not fully dispositive, but the district court hints on them. They were raised in this appeal. The first of which is the question of the requirement of intent. And plaintiff's argument essentially seems to be that once Seven Star was aware of the fact, because of a well blowout, that then gave Seven Star knowledge of gas pressures. Their lack of abating it, then, of doing anything about it, then becomes the intentional tort. I don't think that complies with Kansas law. We don't need to look any further than the Sandifer case, which we cite in our briefs, and particularly the United Protein case, I think is very helpful in that. United Protein looks very much like this case. It looks like a case that was worked up as a permanent damages case, and worked up in a way that was intended to end up in a negligent situation. when the statute of repose prevented those arguments, the court came in and said, it is, you will not allow a new creation of an intentional tort. Actually, you have to have tortious intent at the time and within the statute of limitations period, meaning there has to be.
Let me interrupt you a second. Didn't both of those cases involve a single episode? Whereas the argument here is there are two blowouts. And so why isn't there a pattern here when Southern Star had some awareness of the potential problem in 2008, and then there was a blowout in 2017 and in 2021? Why is that not different than the two cases you mentioned, where what you had was only a single episode that did not provide the same predicate of notice?
Let me answer that two ways. The first of which is that there is no evidence that the blowouts in this case were caused by any action of Southern Star. And that's important. For an intentional tort, you need an act. The plaintiffs have never been clear on what the act was that was intentionally tortious that was committed by Southern Star. There's evidence in the record that the any migration of gas would not have been caused by Southern Star, but caused by continued oil rich. That's what the record says. The second piece of that is that there's no evidence that the blowouts were caused by high pressure gas. There are a lot of factual scenarios that can cause a well blowout. Plaintiffs don't have any evidence one way or the other about these particular blowouts. All they have is evidence in the record that the blowouts occur. And then finally, and maybe more directly getting to your question, the lack of ability or the turning of an intentional tort into something that doesn't require intent would mean that you need an act. So if the situation is, and I would submit to the court that it is, that the blowout happens and that a second blowout happened, even assuming that those two things happened because of high pressure gas, you still need something that Southern Star did. If those two blowouts happened because of circumstance, because once this was set into motion, there wasn't anything that could be done, that doesn't rise to the level of an intentional.
Well, if there were two instances of blowouts that were associated, we're talking for the moment, let's assume hypothetically, two instances of blowouts that were caused by high pressure gas, and the Southern Star is involved in and knows of the migration of high pressure gas, whether they caused the two blowouts or not, why doesn't that amp up the level of substantial certainty such that when something happens that is caused by Southern Star, that they can be held to be responsible for it? They're on notice that this kind of problem occurs. They have seen concrete instances of it occurring, whether they caused it or not, and then they continue to do what they're doing. Why isn't that a problem?
And the question there, the piece of it, is they continue to do what they're doing. What is the evidence of what they're doing? They have a storage field. They are allowed to put high-pressure gas into that storage field. The real crux of that question is, have they done anything that is tortious related to their storing of gas in the storage field?
Well, if those two prior instances ramp up the level of substantial certainty that if they don't take mitigative, evasive action relative to their storage of high pressure gas, that there will be another blowout or there will be damage, why aren't they going to be held responsible for that? Because I'm talking the level of substantial certainty that would occur such that there would be an intentional tort.
Let me make sure. The standard for case requires that at the time of the action is when the intentional mental status has to arrive. If you can't act in 1 year and then have things happen many years later if you didn't have the intent at the time the action was taken. So I think that's the first answer. The second is that may well be a situation where there is a tort that applies. It's just not an intentional tort. Maybe that's a negligent act, but it's not an intentional tort if it doesn't necessarily have that thought process at the time of an action, not of an inaction.
All right. Counsel for appellant, appellee has run over through my peppering of questions, and so if you want a minute, you have it. If not, we'll consider the case submitted. You don't have to take it.
I'll try the minute, Your Honor. The need for some act is clearly established by the proof that the insertion of high pressure storage gas led originally to the migration into the upward formation, not just oil producers as suggested by Ms. Wood. And there's a lot of expert testimony on that. And so that high pressure is continually present in the storage field, and there's no other source of the high pressure. And we cite in our group expert testimony from their own expert as to the problems created by the migration of storage gas. And I think that is clearly the intention of the court. Thank you.
Case is submitted. Thank